was also a college president during the debates over divestment from South African-related stock. If you own stock in a company, you do that because you believe that company is going to succeed and you're going to make a profit. You are then a partner with that company, and the way the fossil fuel companies make profits is if they sell more fossil fuels, which produces more carbon dioxide, which makes the train move a little faster, to use Becca's analogy. So I'm a very strong believer that colleges, universities, museums should not be invested in fossil fuel companies. It's not even a good investment if you look at the future, because the reserves of these companies, which are a major part of their valuation, at some point we're going to decide these can't come out of the ground. They have to stay there. And if those companies have not adapted by going to some other form
James
of
Powell,
renewable energy.
I want to thank you for being with us. We have to end it there. Former president of Reed College and Franklin and Marshall, and former president of Franklin Institute, and former director of the Los Angeles County Museum, Natural History Museum. And thank you so much to Becca Konomopoulos.
And please, folks, go
thank
to
you.
thenaturalhistorymuseum.org.
We have to leave it there. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with our host, Joanne Hardesty. Today, we'll examine mental health treatment at the Avel Gordley Center for Healing at OHSU's Department of Psychiatry.
Tune into Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland. Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean Zouk share the airwaves with African high life, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Good morning, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am your host, Joanne Hardesty, and today we will be talking about mental health, specifically culturally specific mental health. And I have in the studio a unique opportunity today because all of us around this table are either board members or staff with the Avel Gordley Center for Healing. And I'm going to tell you about my all-star cast that I have here with me. I'm going to start with former state representative Mary Nolan. As a state representative, Mary Nolan helped push through Senate Bill 1 in 2005 that required insurance companies to pay for mental health services the same way they pay for physical health services. In 2009, she negotiated the funding for the Healthy Kids program by convincing insurance companies and hospitals to support a new tax to pay for care for over 100,000 uninsured children. She worked as vice president of community development implementing the Affordable Care Act, as also known as Obamacare, by bringing 75,000 Portland area adults into the Oregon Health Plan and helping them get medical care, dental services, and mental health care. Welcome to the studio, Mary Nolan.
Joanne, it's wonderful to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to have you here. Next, I have the fabulous... I can't believe I did. Shabri Vickers, and she is Vice President of Brand Experience and Big Sisters at Big Brothers Big Sisters Columbia Northwest. She also is chair of the city's Portland Human Rights Commission, or will be as of April 1st. She's on the executive committee of the Portland African American Leadership Forum, and she is the board chair of Groundworks Portland. Welcome to the studio, Shabri.
Thank you so much, Joanne.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. So that's guest number two. And guest number three, a native Oregonian, Dr. Alicia Moreland Kapoor, is a physician, scholar, educator, and orator. That she is. Her thoughtful leadership mobilizes our community to respond to critical social needs of the day. The newly appointed Chief Medical Director for Volunteers of America, Oregon, a local branch of the national organization that provides social services throughout the U.S., Dr. Moreland Kapoor is a rising star with a fierce commitment to compassion and intelligent leadership. Dr. earned her degree from Stanford University, an MD from George Washington University, and after medical school, she returned to Portland, where she completed 4 years of training in psychiatry and fellowship in addiction medicine, both at Oregon Health Science University. And with that, welcome, Dr. Moreland Kapoor.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you all here today. I am so excited by this conversation. And I think we will start with you, Doctor, by just giving us what is the Avell Gordley Center for Healing?
So the as many of you probably know, the history of the Avell Gordley Center for Healing is the center is named after our great Senator Avell Gordley, who had the privilege of serving with both Mary and Joanne in the Oregon legislature. And Senator Gordley has been a champion for mental health for many years, and Oregon Health and Science University acknowledged that strong work and her efforts by renaming one of our clinics almost about 8 years ago after her. So now it is called the OHSU Avell Gordley Center for Healing. And specifically, there was a recognized need for more what we call culturally specific care, where we provide care for populations that traditionally had not been well or effectively served, particularly in the areas of mental health. And the goal of the Avell Gordley Center when it started and even today as it continues to provide care for particularly communities of color is to bring down the barriers of shame and embarrassment around mental health, to recognize mental health as a very viable, important part of overall health in terms of keeping communities healthy and whole and restoring families. And so that has been the work that we have been committed to. And then also at the Avell Gordley Center, part of being culturally specific is not just saying it by name, but we also have providers who are culturally specific. So there's a number of African-American providers who then render services for African-American clientele. And then there's a large outreach component where we are educating the community, and I would consider this to be a part of that. And thank you, Ms. Hardesty, for allowing us to come onto the show and to talk about this very important issue. But it's outreach. How do we educate to help sort of change behaviors, hearts, and minds about mental health, which it actually is very important. What we know from statistics is that 1 in 3 African Americans will have a mental health issue, but will only 33% will go and actually pursue treatment. So that means that 2/3 of folks who are in the African American community never ever go pursue treatment, and they sort of do it at home. Right. You know, they struggle through it. They drink a little more. They maybe dibble and dabble into other things, and it manifests itself in really weird ways. And so what we want to do is open up the space and say there is a place for you to receive help, and there are people who understand the depth, the width, and sort of the height of these issues and are willing to meet you where you are and to serve you. So that is sort of in a nutshell what the Avell Gordley Center for Healing is.
You do that extremely well. I want to go to a former legislator, Mary Nolan, and asked about removing the stigma, because the mission statement clearly states that part of our role is to remove the stigma around mental health. And why do you think that's important?
First of all, I want to thank you again for hosting us, but I also want to thank Dr. Moreland. Alicia has such a fabulous way of describing this in a way that's accessible to people.
That's right.
The issue around mental health is that we have for centuries treated mental health as if it is somehow different than physical health, almost as if the brain isn't part of the body.
Right.
And now when we went through the whole process in the legislature of saying clearly that it's the state policy that we treat mental health needs on a par with physical health needs, that changes whether insurance companies cover it and what kind of access is available for patients. It hasn't yet by itself changed the way people think of it, the way people think of themselves and identifying as having a mental health need. There's been such a long history that says mental health is a moral failing, that if someone is has a mental health issue, that somehow they can just suck it up, be strong, and as Alicia mentioned, fix it at home. It's only really recently that the general public has come to understand what the psychiatrists and research experts have said, that there are actual chemical issues in the way the brain works that can't be self-treated. So spending time talking with all of your fabulous radio listeners about this is one way. Some of the other efforts that the board is working on, the board at the Avell Gordley Center is working on, will be outreach to open up particularly to younger audiences, 15 to 25-year-olds, that there are options and there are people who can help them in a way that is comfortable for them and on their own space.
Excellent. And so I want to ask Shabri whether or not the necessity for cultural competence. I heard Alicia talk about, you know, people get to see people who look like them. And so I'm going to put you on the spot because as another Black woman, I want you to answer the question, what are some of the conversations you hear around mental health treatment? I mean, are people comfortable having that conversation?
Not enough, not comfortable enough. And I think not only being here today, and again, Joanne, thank you so much for having us here. what Dr. Kapugia and the Avell Gordley Center is doing is more than just saying it's okay and we have doctors that look like you. It's about increasing our community's knowledge, even just around trauma-informed care. What does that mean to have a community who recognizes the difference between someone who has, in fact, you know, had some sort of trauma in their life, and what does that mean for them as they walk around in the community, in the Portland community, in Oregon as a whole? And it allows for our community members, our board members, who it's just an entire roster of rock stars, to really go back to their places of business and work and profession and recognize what's going on in the community. And they can also ensure that they can dispel myths, that they can just cascade information down to the folks that they work with, and also bring up really important issues. And culturally competent care is absolutely important. It doesn't just look like someone who looks like me, although we know that that, especially now, and I don't think anyone can deny the kind of racially charged community that we're in right now, whether you talk post-Ferguson or in Portland, if you want to talk post-Kendra Jane, whatever you want to talk about, our community is at least aware that race is an issue, whether you want to race together or whatever you want to do. It's happening. And so the recognition that not only is service important, Mary, you were there and helped ensure that, like you said, insurance companies could look at mental health as an issue that insurance companies should cover. But now we're also recognizing that when you have a special, specialized, really intentional care capacity available in the community, it needs to be made available to folks, and especially to a community who hasn't and who has not decided usually to engage in that type of treatment or even, you know, looking at that as an option.
Thank you. If you've just joined the conversation, we are talking about the Avril Gordley Center for Healing at OHSU. I am here in the studio with Dr. Morlan Kapoor. I am also here with former State Representative Mary Nolan. And I am also here with Vice President. I just love it when I just turn all that stuff over. Vice President of Brand Experience and Big Sister, Big Brothers, Shabree Vickers. And so if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. I think you're absolutely right that one of the biggest challenges we have is trying to remove the stigma of asking for help, right? And we live in a culture where especially women are culturalized to, you know, we've got to do it all. We've got to be there for everybody. We've got to be there for the kids, for the parents, for the, you know, we've just have to, we got to work, we got to do it all. And we are taught from a very, very young age that's just what women do. And so it's hard enough to ask for help being a woman, but being a Black woman with all that that entails as well, it becomes even more difficult. And so just being able to know how to reach out to people. So, like, what's the first step? I mean, if somebody feels like, you know, I need somebody to talk to, right? I'm just not right. What would be the first step for them?
So I want to answer your question, but I want to also back up and respond to a few things that were said, because I want to make sure that we're clear on the language that we're using. So we are using mental health issues and mental illness sort of interchangeably. I don't want us to do that. Okay. I want to clearly separate what it means to be tending to your mental health and what it means to be mentally ill. 100% of the United States of America should be tending to their mental health. Everybody around this table here today should be tending to their mental health. It is an important aspect of overall health and wellness. And what I would say is to have issues where you're feeling like you're depressed or have some anxiety or emotional pain, dealing with that does not make you mentally ill. Okay, that is tending to your mental health. It's a part of overall maintenance, and that's a part of it, having the conversation with folks and saying what you are and what you aren't. The other piece is the recognition that you've said it. People work very hard. They put a lot of pressure on themselves to be perfect, to do all things. It's like, take the cape off. When can you retire the cape? Can we take the S off of our chest for just a moment and to sit down? And the question becomes, you're taking care of everything, but who's taking care of you? And I think traditionally when folks think of mental health care and psychiatrists, they don't think of a person of color. Number one, they probably think of a white male, which is traditionally what is projected and portrayed. They also probably think of medication. You're going to push medication off on me, and then what the other. However, there is this whole other element of mental health treatment that's called counseling, because there's a distinction between counseling and therapy.
Good point.
And sometimes everyone could just use a little bit of advice from a neutral party who's not going to judge you, who can suspend judgment, that's confidential, that gives you sort of a sounding board. It's sort of like there's a whiteboard and you get to draw whatever you want on that board. And then you process it together. It's a facilitation. And that in itself, just creating the space to come and to sort of cast all your cares, if you will. This doesn't take away from going to church. It doesn't take away from family, because there's a role for everybody. There's a role for mama, daddy, grandma, pastor, church, community. And then there's also a role for the professional. We're saying that if all of those things are working together in concert, we can move to a place of complete and ultimate healing. So it doesn't mean that when you come in, we're going to push medication on you. And actually, I don't do that. I'm fairly conservative. I want to understand your story, get the history, and then figure out what's going to best work for you. It could be that we're just doing a few counseling sessions. It could be that we determine overall afterwards that things are a little bit overwhelming and you may need some temporary pharmacotherapeutic intervention, but it doesn't have to be forever. And it's also educating you every step along the way so that you are informed, because I want to make sure you know what I know. So because then when you know what I know, you can make an informed decision and we can have a discussion together. So there's a bidirectionality. There's no longer this unilateral way of doing things. I am the doctor. And yes, I do. I have been in school for 20 years. I do know what I'm talking about. But I want to make sure that you also know what you're talking about, right? So that we can make the decision together. So I think part of that is just educating the community on what the process is now and debunking some of those myths. So I am an African-American woman who is also a psychiatrist. So I'm not the older Freudian looking, sitting on a couch, smoking a cigarette. That's not what we do anymore. Right. So I want to open up the space for people to come in and to explore. Take, you know, retire the cape for a while. Come get the help that you both deserve and need with no shame.
And it's covered by insurance.
Well, and for the most part, there are some co-pays, right. And there still are some, and that's the part that I appreciate Mary Nolan's work around mental health parity and making sure that it gets paid. But we do still have some barriers and some issues around folks coming in, and it becomes an access issue because mm-hmm. now I've got a large co-pay that right. I can't really make, but I need the help, mm-hmm. and there are so many limited visits, so we still have some more work to do yet on that.
Thank you. We have a caller on the line. Hello, Sean. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. I appreciate you addressing this issue. I've been in treatment for chronic mental illness for the better part of the last 30 years. I've had several hospitalizations and so forth, but I've noticed in the last 3 decades a real absence of people of color in treatment, and so I know there's a profound, deep problem when it comes to that issue. But I'd like to address another issue related to cultural competency, and that's the issue of socioeconomic competency. I've gone from a situation where as a minor, I came from a union household with excellent health care coverage, and now as an adult, I'm in poverty, and the difference is just night and day. And for people who are dealing with chronic mental illness, to not have inpatient services available and to be what I like to call being community institutionalization, where you're stuck out in the community in poverty, and the amount of dysfunction, the amount of chaos that goes on with poverty, it's just absurd to think that the chronically mentally ill who are poor are going to receive the services they need when there isn't long-term inpatient care available. And I think that's part of a cultural competency that often gets overlooked, that poor people dealing with mental illness have so many more challenges than, say, upper middle class or upper class folks. And I was hoping you'd address that. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your call. We really appreciate it. And I couldn't agree with you more. What we do with poor people who need mental health treatment is we put them in jail.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do. We put them in jail. We continually to arrest them until they have lots and lots of convictions. And then we put them in prison. And then one day they get out and they come back and we start the cycle all over again. And so I don't dismiss what that gentleman said at all. In fact, at one point, Multnomah County jails had the best mental health treatment that you could get if you were a poor person. I don't believe that they have maintained that standard, but at one point they did. So it's definitely an issue. But it's not the issue that
the comment I wanted to make about that is that we have made some steps, and Dr. Moreland, you're right, they are not complete. We have legal statute requiring that insurance companies treat mental health on a par with physical health, mm-hmm. but there are still efforts taken to cut the corners and shave the services and increase the co-pays and other things that make it difficult to access on all levels and for all communities. We have a shortage of professionals trained and experienced in providing services. That deficit for competent caregivers is even more severe in communities of color, the African-American community. Dr. Moreland told me that she and Dr. Knight Richardson were the only African-American psychiatrists in
the
state.
We now have a third.
But yes, fabulous. But the fact that we could all sit around this table
one hand,
to
right.
serve the entire state yes. says we're not there.
Right.
And in the Latino community, mm-hmm. in the Asian-American community, mm-hmm. we have not only not reached out to patients to make it safe and comfortable for them to access care, we haven't reached out effectively to people who are coming up through high school and college and thinking about their careers and invited them to pursue the kind of training and education that Alicia got to be able to become healthcare providers.
And, you know, Joanne, I just want to go back. So Sean, you know, certainly brought up a point that is absolutely accurate. Poverty and what poverty can do to a community or to a person who's attempting to access anything,
yes,
whether it be food insecurity or anything like that, it's going to exasperate things. Mm. But imagine all of that staring smack dab in the face at the wealth gap that we know exists within our communities.
Right.
And so that to even, and if, you know, I'm certain many of your listeners have heard, if we really look at the wealth gap between, hey, let's say a white male and a black female, I think when we last looked at it, the wealth, like overall was, could be, was it $1 or $5 that was like an accumulated average wealth?
Five. It was $5 for a black woman.
For a black woman. And so, and I simply mention that because having a lack of access to just even being able to pay a copay, and this, and you know, I would assume that this is also a specialist kind of copay. It's not typically on your, you know, just normal get well type stuff. To then be able to go into a place and not have someone that just gets it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean just gets it because they've been through their 20 years of training that every psychiatrist needs to go through. But when you are a person who consistently deals with microaggressions and that kind of death by a thousand cuts type thing, and when you're a person that's supposed to be that strong black woman or that strong black man or just get over it, you know, some of these things, they don't really exist. And, you know, when you're walking around at night and someone, you know, is scared of you, or when, you know, you could be possibly carrying a gun at all times, like all of these things, when you're dealing with all of those things and then also looking into your pocketbook to say, I really need this service, but I can't access it. It simply means there's a lot more work that we have to do. And so, I mean, I am just excited about the work that we're doing at the OHSU Avail Gordley Center for Healing, in particular because there are folks who can't necessarily access that type of coverage at all times. And so being able to share this information and share what's actually happening at this center is absolutely needed. Again, thank you, Joe. I think you're going to be hearing that. Thank you.
All day. I'm a part of this. I think this is so important for Portland to have the Avail Gordley Center for Healing, because it is a model for how you intentionally reach out and engage a population that has a lot of hesitation about obtaining and receiving mental health treatment. I believe we have another caller on the line. Hello, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Yes, hello. Please be patient with me. I'm in my 70s, and this subject is really charged for me, and my heart's beating fast, and I'm working on keeping painful feelings down. I had to take my Social Security disability on being mentally ill, because that's the way the system works, and not on my physical and medical stuff I had then, and even what, the ones I found out later. And I'm on housing and that, and I'm sure everybody that has to work or deal with me in these systems believes and thinks of me as being mentally ill. And I know I'm not mentally ill, but it's in the computer, and it's going to be there, and it's going to be in the computer after I die. And I'd like to see you have more programs on the stigma of mental health. This is so painful. And here I am in my late 70s, almost 80, and after I die, I'm going to be known as mentally ill and worse. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for calling, Joanne. And Joanne, just so you know, we don't think you're mentally ill. You call regularly, and you always add something to the conversation. So just know that we're sending you hugs.
Can I actually respond? So please. I think also what Joanne was speaking to is this idea of labels and being labeled. Mm-hmm. And it is unfortunate. And I think that the fear of being labeled does keep people from coming in to receive the help that they need. And I think it definitely is something that has to, here's what I would offer, and it doesn't take away from the pain of the situation and her interpretation of it. When you go in to see a physical health provider and for three consistent visits, you've had high blood pressure, eventually, at some point, the provider has to say to you, I think you might have like either essential hypertension or you actually have high blood pressure, and that is a diagnosis that goes onto the chart. Then the next provider who looks at the chart can say, oh, I see that you were diagnosed with high blood pressure, and now I'm mindful of it because that diagnosis, and it comes with a set of treatments and expectations for how it's to be managed, and then that means that there are other things that I have to consider when I'm talking with you. So in many respects, having that on the chart helps me to give you more comprehensive care, okay? As opposed to, and people can accept a diabetes mellitus, and you're not diabetes mellitus, you have it. You're not hypertension, you have it. You're not high cholesterol, you have it. You're not mentally ill, you have a mental health issue that you are working through. And so I think, again, there's a fine line between those things, but it should not preclude folks who really desperately need help from coming in to receive the care that, again, that I keep saying that they deserve and need. Mm. And I know in the African American community, the one thing that they say is, I don't need just one more label, mm-hmm. not just one more thing. Mm. And so we get it. And I'm saying, understanding that phenomenon and also reconciling that with the fact that you are hurting and you're doing other things that are maladaptive and dangerous, and there's help for you. So we got to have those tough conversations as well.
503-231-8187 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. Have you experienced trying to seek treatment for a mental illness or mental health services? If you have, give us a call. We'd like to hear from you. Also, how do you think we can outreach to young people and elderly people and let them know that it's safe and it's okay to seek this kind of help? Give us a call if you have some ideas for us. And so what are we going to do? I mean, are we going to go to schools? I mean, we've been talking about maybe developing a video. You don't want me singing on any video, I can tell you that.
Let me tell you, you don't want me singing either.
So let's be clear about that. This side of the table's not singing, okay? Oh, we got a third side that ain't singing.
I'm okay.
So, so a solo act will be performed. So we've been talking about, so what does it take, right? Because everybody wants to reach, quote unquote, young people, right? And so first, let's identify, right? Because do you believe, let me ask this question, do you believe that that there's a certain age that is healthy for young people to have a mental health check-in or connect with mental health providers? And when would that be? What do you think? When do people start having those conversations?
I think it's appropriate to be assessing just as you go get immunizations and do safety checks, to just sort of assess mm-hmm. whether people feel safe, whether they are able to, there are ways to sort of speak to children that don't place them in boxes. It just basically says, you know, how are your emotions? Are you able to manage them? Are they okay? There's a number of, I think it should be something that's consistently checked on and sort of assessed. And I also think it's, you know, I had given the example, I think we had a conversation 4 weeks ago about some of the TV shows that we watch right now.
Oh, right.
And there's this sort of emerging adulthood population between 18 and 40. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is 18 and 40. And and there's a show currently out, and Fox, please don't come get me, called Empire. And 14 million viewers watch that show every week. Okay. And there was a particular episode where one of the sons had a bipolar disorder, and I thought he actually played it very well. And I thought that the writers and producers were trying to bring forth a really important issue. What came out of it was you have Cookie Lyons, who was played by Faraji P. Henson, saying, "What is this bipolar stuff?" And then you have the father, Lucius Lyons, who is played by, what is his name? Terrence Howard. Who basically says, you will not call my son mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And so we have all these sort of competing messages. This is popular culture. Mm-hmm. Folks are watching, and those messages are powerful. Right. So then you have little old me over here trying to fight against Fox Network saying, hey, come on, let's not say it like that. Right. What you should be saying is, we're going to get you that. But you saw that he was getting the help he needed.
Right.
But it's sort of, there's this language around, there's the push and pull. We need you, but we don't want you. We need you, but we don't want you. So I think that we've got a lot of work to do in sort of educating the community, bringing down those barriers, welcoming people to come in as they are, to explore their fears, hopes, wishes, dreams, all of that. So
you know what's interesting? That episode, and I'm not... typically ever going to be heard saying that Fox did a fantastic job with anything.
Not too often. It won't happen too often.
But I think one of the things that that show did do outside of, first of all, it showed the issue, right? Which was huge because there were 14 million viewers. And in particular, a group of folks who were watching it, we know is a high population of African Americans who were watching it. What it did do for millennials like myself as a 30-year-old, what you saw was the failure of both Cookie Lyons and Lucius Lyons to really recognize what he needed. Mm-hmm. And so while I think it literally pulled the veil up over what is happening in many Black communities, and I think it did it and it allowed the viewers to be smart with what they were seeing. Because right away, when you saw Cookie say, that's not, you know, what is this stuff? You recognize that she had a lack of just education based upon that. Mm-hmm. You know, when Lucius Lyons is saying, you're not going to do this, what happened is the viewers recognized. And I think for many young Black viewers, for even older Black viewers, what they were able to see was the failure of those two parents to really step up where they needed to. And so, it helped to normalize the fact that this treatment that he was going to get was not only something that he needed, but was something that was going to literally serve him and serve both Lucius and Cookie Lyons. And so
I'm going to have to watch this show.
But I think it did a good job of putting right in front of you what's going to happen and allowing you to kind of walk with that. And I also think you were able to see that those two parents, while they love that boy, while they love Andre, he was not being serviced as well as he could be because his family was not there to support.
Because they didn't understand.
Because they didn't understand it. They loved him, but they didn't understand it. So.
And it's hard. I didn't see the episode either, Joanne. So I don't want to speak to the way it was portrayed in that episode. But one of the things that we are exploring as we talk about education outreach and reaching to the community is to find a way to be there in the space that they're in now. Mm-hmm. That while we want to change the language, and Doc, I really, really appreciate that you helped us focus on mental health. Mm-hmm. Is not the same. I mean, those conversations are not the same as mental illness. Mm-hmm. And having a particular condition, whether it's ongoing or temporary, doesn't mean that that changes you. It just means it's something you have, like diabetes, mm-hmm. or like
high blood pressure
or anything. Mm-hmm. But the other thing we're trying to stretch as we think about ways to have this conversation with the community is, how do we do it from where they are now, from where what their understanding is, whether the they are the parents, mm-hmm. Which is a generation I can relate to, or whether they are some of the younger, mm-hmm. 18 to 40-year-olds that Shabri can relate to, because that's the world she moves in, and how do we do that in a way that speaks their language, mm-hmm. but subtly helps change their language in a way to take away some of the implied derogatory elements and the judgment aspects of it.
I so agree with you, and I do want to comment on that, but we've got callers lined up, so we're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Nancy. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. You have a great program.
Thank you.
Excuse me. I just wanted to mention Ritalin and the treatment of a fourth grader when my daughter was in school. This was some time ago. Mm-hmm. And there are so many alternatives in our community, but how in the world did they decide behaviorally that little boy needed Ritalin? And I think it's overused in the schools, and someone affirmed that in the African-American community recently, and I'd like to hear more about that, because that's a very young age. It can change them, and they may have to depend on certain drugs throughout their lives as a result. So I don't know how careful the school district is.
Well, thank you for the question. I appreciate that. I would say that the school district is probably not prescribing drugs, but school nurses, there's a lot of kids that are taking medication in our public school system, and that sounds like another show.
it does, and I mean, I appreciate the question. Again, we want to be careful, especially with our our children to make sure that we are optimizing our ability to do the most good for them. And in optimizing our ability to do the most good, that means that we do want to make sure that we're getting assessments, but also it's proper to, it's totally appropriate to question those things, mm-hmm. to really research them, to study them. What we also don't want to fall guilty of is because of our own fears around things not allowing children to get the help that they may need. That does not mean that you can't have thoughts, opinions, and even second opinions on those things. So again, it's opening up the space to have the conversations, even though they might be hard.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is actually one of the points where culturally competent care makes sense. So mm-hmm. if this family, and again, Nancy, thanks for bringing this up. I think as a parent of a young fourth grader, I think of a lot of her classmates as well. But I think what also happens is when we see young children who are, as we know, disproportionately pushed into special ed or different classes, and they are deemed with, you know, this kid is just, I can't deal with him, not sure what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. If this child were able to go to a place or be connected to a provider who could say, oh, I get this, mm-hmm. And understand what that means, maybe that that prescription would not have been there, or maybe it would have been. I mean, we don't know, and I don't want to ideate around each person.
What it would have been is probably a more stretch of options. Because right. what I do agree with Nancy is that there are more than just one option.
Right.
Yeah.
There's certainly more than one option, and I think it's just an apropos time for folks in the community to have providers who can recognize a lot. I mean, you know, every time you mention my title, Vice President of Brand Experience and Big Sister, that's there for a reason. I, you know, when I was matched with my first little sister, this girl was 7 years old, and I'm obviously not going to be naming any names, but she, when they asked her, what do you want your big sister to know about you? Mm-hmm. She said, well, I want her to know that I have anger issues, and, you know, I've been told I'm manipulative, and I'm thinking, this is what
a seven-year-old
is wanting me, her big sister, who she's excited to see, right. to know before she's ever met me.
Wow.
And right away, I'm saying to myself, well, who has given you those labels, right? Mm-hmm. Where has that come from? What does that do to yourself? And what is that going to do to your experiences and the way that you carry yourself, right? We rise up to our expectations. And, you know, I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking, almost every seven-year-old I know is going to want to get that extra scoop of ice cream or stay up a little bit longer or something like that. And so I think it certainly looks like being able to see and recognize someone that you can relate to and someone who can look at and really look at the whole picture, like you said, more options.
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, the whole, I'm going to go back to the phone line. Because we have other callers on the line. Hello, Dan. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder that I received 35 years ago. And I take my medication, which is Zyprexa 10 milligrams and Haldol 5 milligrams every night. And I also have I'm a recovering alcoholic. And things started turning around for me as soon as after I got sober and clean from marijuana. And I was able to fortunately I had a bachelor's degree before I got my diagnosis, but after my diagnosis in 2001 I was able to go back to school and get a master's degree in social work, and right now I work in a group home for the mentally ill as a residential counselor. And I was wondering the point I want to make is that a lot of mental illness has to do with also the drug and alcohol abuse. And I was wondering if you could speak to that point.
Well, thank you so much for the question.
Absolutely. I think that what you're speaking to, Dan, is dual diagnosis. And of course, as a lot of folks would say, you know, I could go into sort of the pharmacology of it. Like, so for instance, let's take cigarettes, for example. We know that nicotine itself in cigarettes helps with focus. It helps with concentration. It increases energy. It's sort of like a stimulant. So it does help and serve in that capacity. And then tobacco in cigarettes actually has an antidepressant effect. And so many people who are smoking cigarettes are treating something, right? We know that it has an antidepressant effect. We know that alcohol works on GABA receptors and treats anxiety. So my point is that I'm going through all of this, and I could go through the sort of pharmacology of it and the physiology of it. The point is that typically when folks do have some sort of mood component, there is some sort of concomitant substance use associated with it. Not all the time, but dual diagnosis is more consistent. And what I mean by dual diagnosis is you'll have someone with an axis one diagnosis of depression or anxiety, and then you'll also have either alcohol use disorder or cannabis use disorder or methamphetamine. And the question is, which comes first? Is it the drug use or the actual mental health condition? And at this point, it really sort of, in many cases, I don't say it doesn't matter, but it is important to be effectively treating both, because I don't feel like you can really put a dent in someone's sort of substance use issues if you haven't tended to the longstanding protracted depression that they've had for years and years that stem from childhood trauma. So your point is well taken. And I think, again, my specialty is addiction psychiatry. And when you come to see me, you're going to get a full assessment of all of those things and how the interplay between the two, because there is a very real intersection between those things. And you can't really treat one without treating the other effectively, in a nutshell.
Thank you for that. That's about all I wanted to say. I'm glad you're having this program. I think it increases the awareness and at the same time decreases the stigma, which is another thing. You know, I wear my label like a badge, because I consider it courageous to be working in the system, with the system, and yet succeed as a consumer, and I use that label loosely too. I'm also a survivor, and so I think it takes a certain amount of courage to be a survivor in the system.
Well, not to mention that you are a model to the people that you're working with, that there is another way, that there's the other side, right?
Right.
And you could tell people that morning, noon, and night, but actually until they see someone who's walked in their shoes, it doesn't mean as much. So thank you for what you do.
Yes, kudos, Dan.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks, Tim. Bye now. I remember what I wanted to say earlier. My friends who are disabled will tell you that we are all temporarily able, right? And I believe it is also true when we talk about mental health. We are all temporarily mentally healthy, right? And it is our goal to try to stay mentally healthy. Right. And so I just recently made that connection, because just like, you know, we don't know when we're going to be disabled, but we know the statistics show that at some point in our life, we're not going to be able to do all the things that we do today. Right. So,
well, and we all have different capabilities and physical skills. It shouldn't surprise us. You know, we laughed about, Joanne, you and I shouldn't sing in any video we make for kids. And yet, maybe Alicia has a fabulous voice. And
she's like, oh, yeah, I'll do that.
Right, exactly.
She has strengths and capabilities in one area. I can throw a softball only so far. You know, you have different talents than I do. We haven't collectively, and maybe this is just a self-confession here, I haven't really thought until I've spent some time focusing on mental health and taking care of it, not just responding to mental illness, but taking affirmative care of mental health, that the brain functions differently. My daughter is an amazing, amazing artist. I'm a mathematician. She hates math, and she can create art that there is no way my hands could create. And finding ways to understand that that's just the way her brain interacts with the world,
right?
And yours and mine interacts in a different way.
Very good point. And we've got callers lined up. They're stacked up. Next call, please.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
Yes, I'm one of the people that, like some others that called earlier, I'm in my late 70s. I've been in the mental health system for many, many years of my life. First, before I came to Portland, I was in California, where I was in the mental was being treated in Santa Cruz, California, and I'm familiar with the mental health system there. Then I came up to Portland after I retired. You mentioned somebody in mathematics. I taught college mathematics all my life. That's what I did, and I retired, and I came up here, and I was very, very pleased to find a very good, I thought, mental psychiatrist here. His name was Kevin Smith, and he was at OHSU. Hmm. And then finally, about 3 years ago, the plug was pulled out from under me. He left. And not only he left to form a clinic in, I believe, Vancouver, British Columbia, and with him, a whole bunch of people there at OHSU left. I couldn't get anything, and that's why I'm very pleased. And he referred me to somebody at Providence, where I've been going. But I'm very, very interested in this, in what your
discussion.
Whatever. No, I'm very interested in this. I'm sorry, your guests have...
The Avell Gordley Center for Healing?
Absolutely. I've never heard of it before, and I would like to make sure that I find out how I connect with that, and I really appreciate that your program about this, and, for me to have had this person pull away from me, and then, I'm being treated now by a young person at Providence, but I would like to find out more about this other thing that you were talking about. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If you would be kind enough to stay on the line, I have a phone number that I'm going to have my engineer give you. So if you just hang on, okay? Appreciate you calling. Did you want to comment, or you want me to just go back to the phone?
Well, I think that's awesome that you're calling. We don't want to steal you from Providence, but give us a call at 503-494-4745, and we'll get you some help. Thanks for calling. Be well.
Okay. On that note, let me tell you what's coming up today on Naboo. At 9, it's Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell. Get all the news you're not supposed to know, and then some. At 10 is Eric Cascadia with cutting-edge news, views, interviews, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15 is Flashpoints, investigative news journalist with host Dennis Bernstein. Today we'll hear about Venezuela's claims that the United States is destabilizing their country. Plus, we'll examine the recently released CIA report that justified the war in Iraq. Finally, we'll look at how money is corrupting our election system again. At 11 on Between the Covers, we feature interviews with locally and nationally known authors of both fiction and nonfiction. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures with host Jean Chavez and Southwest Concert. Today's guests are Larlo Forte, who directs the North Portland Multimedia Training Center, Vanport Multimedia Project, and veteran filmmaker Todd Dalling, who is returning to Portland. That's what's coming up today on Naboo. If you didn't become a member during our last membership drive, you still have the opportunity. Just go online to kboo.fm and click the tip jar. Before we wrap this program up, I have to ask, because Dr. Kapoor is now serving on the Community Oversight Advisory Board that's actually looking at reforms to Portland Police Bureau. And part of her tasks as this part of this advisory board is to push for systemic change within the Bureau. Now that the Bureau actually has a behavioral health unit, I know that the COAB will be looking very closely at how that behavioral health unit operates. Do you have anything you want to share about COAB and how people can engage with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the next actual general meeting is April 2nd at 5:30 p.m. at the Charles Jordan Center at 909009 North Foss. And so we encourage you to come out and hear a little bit more. But what we are interested in doing is making sure that moving forward that there's training and accountability. And of course, the space between training and accountability is change. And the change that we are seeking is for practices, for procedures, namely around how the Portland Police Bureau engages with persons with known mental illness, persons of color, persons with disability, other marginalized groups. And a part of that is around this idea, Shabray brought it up earlier, about sort of trauma-informed care. What does that mean, or being trauma-informed? And there's a whole large discussion on that that we will, that's definitely an agenda that I'll be pushing with the COAB as well as with the Portland Police Bureau. So we invite you to come out and hear a little bit more about that.
And is that a town hall meeting that's happening
on
the 2nd?
It's a town hall meeting April 2nd at the Charles Jordan, Center?
Community Center. Mm-hmm. You know, Joanne, as a member of the Human Rights Commission and a part of the leadership, I am so excited that not only has the COAB been seated, but that when they are looking into this DOJ settlement and really going down each of the items and ensuring that they hold the PPB and the City of Portland accountable to those things, that we have folks like Dr. Moreland Kapuya sitting around the table who not only can look at and utilize those 20 years of education to ensure that mental illness is treated in the best way, but is held to the highest level of knowledge, but it's also intentional. And what we did know, and what we know on the Human Rights Commission and many folks who've been looking at the DOJ settlement, is that while race was left off of the settlement in particular, there are little ways that it's been put back into place. And right now, with someone like Dr. Kapuya sitting at the table, what we do know is that that intentional look that you have, that's just innate within you, because of who you are, but because of also your education, is going to be at the forefront of that work and what we should see and experience as a community. So thank you for the time spent there as well.
And thank you. And Shabray's giving all the praise, but Shabray and Emmanuel Price are also representative of the Human Rights Commission, and their perspective is also rich. And what I also hear Joanne Hardesty and Shabray saying is, you better get it right, Dr. Moreland Kapuya.
Yeah, right. Oh, we're coming for you.
We're watching. You have support.
We've definitely got your back. But this is critical for our community.
Absolutely.
Getting this particular piece right is absolutely critical.
Absolutely.
Because we've been dealing with this issue for decades in this community. And so I am proud of the committee that's been seated. We worked very hard to make sure that committee reflected.
And your work with AMA.
With the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform.
Yeah.
Yes. And we will always be watching, because that's what we do around police reform. Mm-hmm. But it's really important, April 2nd, if you're able to come out. I'm going to try to squeak in one more call.
Okay.
Hello, Francis. Can you do it in 30 seconds or less, please?
Yeah, I have a question about diagnosis and stigmatizing. A young man I know whose cousin was killed by the police, we noticed. He has reoccurring dreams. He's been diagnosed with hypertension already. He's 30 years old. But he has reoccurring dreams about that incident. Not necessarily the incident, but being in social gatherings where at some point his friend Keaton says to him, "Man, I have my hands up." Every time the dream ends that way. And he said, "Man, I think I'm suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome." And I'm wondering if anybody has looked at how much post-traumatic stress young men are experiencing in our community right now, just from the things they deal with on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
I so wish you had asked that question about a half hour ago.
It's hard to get in.
But thank you. I understand. Thank you for the question. We'll try to get a quick response.
The quick response is yes, we've considered it. We look at racial trauma, intergenerational trauma, vicarious trauma, all of it, and we're dealing with it. And that's what I mean when we say that we're a facility that is trauma-informed. The Avail Gordley Center for Healing is trauma-informed and addresses all of that. So thank you for your question and the call.
Yes, I absolutely appreciate that. And I also want to let you know that the next Human Rights Commission meeting will be at the Office of Equity and Human Rights on April 1st at 4 p.m. And you can look online to get any additional information for that. Thank you all for being here today. What an all-star team in this studio. I am so pleased and honored to work with all of you on the Avail Center for Healing. And just to know you all as friends, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Joanne.
And listeners, I will see you next week. Same time, playing, same station, same day of the week, I guess. Okay, see you then.
you're right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
And just a minute now before 9 o'clock. Good morning from KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Waiting in the wings, it's Teresa Mitchell with all the news you're not supposed to know on Press Watch. Join us in an hour for Air Cascadia. It's cutting-edge news, views, interviews, and all sorts of interesting stuff from Chris Andre. And then at 10:15, join us for Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, we'll feature interviews with locally and nationally known authors. As a matter of fact, today we have author Alexandra Fuller being featured, talking about her latest book, Leaving Before the Rains Come. That will be coming your way at 11 o'clock. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures with host Jen Chavez and SW Concer. It's going to be a good show today with guest Laura Loforti, who directs the North Portland Multimedia Training Center's Vanport Multimedia Project, and veteran filmmaker Todd Darling, who is returning to Portland. That is all coming up this morning. Stick around. Teresa Mitchell is next on KBOO.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every